morning. The Veterans Military Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. It's Thursday, February 24th, about 8:30 a.m. Good morning to everybody. And before we get started, if you would join me in honoring our country with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, thank you, and again, good morning. Welcome to the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee. This morning we have on our agenda a couple of presentations, starting with the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, MACV as it's affectionately known. We do have another presentation just after that about the Veterans Day on the Hill, and then we have a couple of bills up at the end of the committee. So with that, I see we have our presenter here, Mr. Neil Loydolt, President and CEO of Minnesota Assistance for Council for Veterans. Sir, good morning. If you would, identify yourself for the record. Proceed.
Good morning, Chair Lang. My name is Neil Loydolt. I'm with the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. We're a 501c3 nonprofit operating throughout the state of Minnesota with our mission to end veteran homelessness in Minnesota. I began with MACV in February of 2017 after leaving full-time service with the Minnesota National Guard. It seems hard to believe now, but I'm entering my sixth year here at MACV, and these last 2 years operating through the COVID pandemic and the civil unrest, I'm really quite proud, I guess I should say, of how well our team has done, our ability to respond, to keep our doors open, to work remotely and figure out new and innovative ways to try to help the veterans who have the greatest need through, you know, electronic means. We used to think you had to go face-to-face to make that work, and still that's a better solution for some veterans, but you can serve a lot of a veteran's needs if you can figure out how to connect with them remotely. We have served veterans experiencing at risk of homelessness now for over 30 years. We do so with a wide-reaching, comprehensive network of staff and partners throughout the state. This just isn't us. I'm proud of their experience and professionalism as well, but most importantly, the compassion that they show for the veterans that they serve. This can be terribly difficult work to try to help somebody, you know, put themselves back on track again and get into a better situation and bring them back to the status that a lot of them were in when they serve. We coordinate comprehensive services for long-term housing stability, employment, and legal services. Our services cover the entire state of Minnesota with offices in St. Paul, Duluth, St. Cloud, Moorhead, Mankato, and Rochester. The key to success in our programs is the combination of individualized services that each veteran receives, along with an organization-wide goal for all veterans to achieve or maintain stable housing. We try to do quite a bit more in that maintain lane during the course of the pandemic because we're just better off if we can avoid that crisis, the financial crisis, the moral crisis, the personal trauma that that occurs to a veteran when they become homeless. Our team of 65 staff, over half of whom are veterans themselves, is talented, diverse, and committed to ending veteran homelessness. We do operate 151 beds of transitional and permanent supportive housing units in Duluth, Hibbing, Mankato, St. Cloud, and throughout the Twin Cities metropolitan area. We have 9 additional units coming online in April of this year in North Minneapolis. We're trying to improve our presence in North Minneapolis. And an additional 24 starting construction in spring, with the goal to complete those yet in 2022 as well. This figure represents an increase of 21 available housing units since I last testified to this committee in 2021. Strong partnerships with Lennar Builders, Housing First Minnesota Foundation, and Hennepin County have been sort of directly responsible for us being able to pursue these projects. When I last spoke with you in January of 2021, I informed you that during the pandemic, we benefited from greater flexibility in the use of our federal funding, as well as additional funds. We placed 455 veterans experiencing homelessness into our hotel emergency shelter program in 2020 and 2021, with an average stay of 53 days and 65% of all time hotel exits reported as positive. That means either the veteran left willingly or they are now in a stable housing solution, because some people just left the hotel because it wasn't for them. But we are glad to report that our need for the use of hotels as emergency shelter has reduced by nearly 50% compared to its peak. And we now apply the lessons we learned working with veterans in those spaces to our outreach efforts in sheltered and unsheltered spaces. We are working very diligently now to identify permanent and transitional housing options for only the 26 veterans that remain in our emergency hotel program. This effort has also, though, resulted in record amounts of direct client assistance spending, with our budget for this service area doubling over the course of the pandemic. And you can understand why, if we're paying for individual hotel rooms, even at a reduced rate, that's going to be significantly more expensive than putting veterans into normal housing. With the end of the eviction moratorium, our staff has seen an uptick in veterans needing legal and financial assistance, and we continue to reach out to previously served veterans, community partners, and through media and social media networks to make sure that veterans are aware of the resources that are available to them. This empowers the veteran community as well to stay ahead of the potential crisis that we might be facing. We haven't seen it yet, but we might be facing relative to the end of the eviction moratorium. We are prepared for a significant case management effort and investment of rental assistance resources to help veterans avoid eviction and becoming homeless. Data about the extent of the need resulting from the moratorium's end is inexact. We know that many of the households most financially affected by the COVID-19 pandemic are veterans who live paycheck to paycheck without any financial safety net or savings. This group disproportionately includes veterans of color, but also veterans in rural communities, families, and veterans who have never needed assistance before of any kind, but do so now because of the past circumstances. Our team leverages a variety of federal and philanthropic resources to address the pressing need for assistance, but the funds appropriated to MACV by the Minnesota Legislature are especially critical to our mission success. We are proud to count the state of Minnesota as one of our strongest allies in the fight to end veteran homelessness. In 2021, we enrolled 1,438 veterans into comprehensive services. Of those individuals, 61% have a documented disability. 52% are 55 years of age or older. That usually surprises some people. That is the majority of the population that we serve. 38% have children. 37% identify as veterans of color. And 11% were female veterans. 837 veterans received direct financial assistance from us in 2021 for a total amount of over $3.2 million. Of this, 239 veterans received financial assistance with the funds appropriated by the Minnesota Legislature, by you all, to help us augment the federal funding and to reach some people that doesn't reach as well. Employment services continue to be a key focus of our service delivery to veterans, because you still have to be able to pay your rent somehow. In 2021, we placed 193 veterans into an employment with an average hourly wage of $17.72 per hour, representing annual gross wages of approximately $4.5 million. 87% of the veterans who got jobs through our program last year were still employed in the follow-up survey. The funding you provide us directly impacts the achievements of these outcomes. So thank you very much. In the past year, we have strategically grown our service provision capacity in various areas, including direct street outreach to unsheltered veterans, landlord navigation and engagement to find housing options for homeless veterans with barriers to securing a rental lease. Since October of 2019, our landlord engagement program has housed over 110 veterans with significant justice involvement and very complicated rental histories. The average veteran housed through this program has one felony, one eviction, two misdemeanors, and owes at least $1,000 or more to a past landlord. Many also struggle with mental and chemical health challenges and low financial literacy. However, of the 110, not a single veteran housed through that program has been evicted, and over 90% of those housed since the program's inception remained housed. Healthcare navigation, to ensure that veterans have access to the physical, mental, and chemical health resources that they need to succeed. As we've discussed before, not all veterans are eligible for VA services, and healthcare navigation helps connect those veterans to other services to ensure that we utilize every option available to help stabilize housing. There are so many resources available that it can be daunting for anyone to learn or understand them all, especially if you're already struggling through that sort of homeless trauma. This team helps connect veterans to the service that will best resolve their housing instability. Expansion of our Justice Involved Veteran Initiative, which engages veterans pre-release from correctional institutions and with homeless veterans with the most serious criminal barriers to housing. Most veterans exiting incarceration cite homelessness status as a key component contributing to their reincarceration. We identify veterans prior to release to ensure they get on a path to stable housing in an effort to reduce recidivism. These strategic initiatives will continue into 2022 and beyond as we continue to adjust our resources to the community that we serve. When I spoke with you in 2021, I informed you that during the pandemic, our progress of housing an average of 57.6 homeless veterans per month had been cut in half. In fact, I think we had some spirited debate about that, falling to as low as 28 placements per month at the peak of COVID. The good news is I'm happy to report that since then, since November of 2021, the number of veterans experiencing homelessness in Minnesota is progressively going down from the plateau experienced of around 300 plus, to its current number today of 245 veterans on the registry. As stated in 2019, I am optimistic that we are back on track to achieve a functional end of veteran homelessness in Minnesota over the next 2 years. It should be noted that the numbers I have been briefing over the years do not represent the same 200, 250, or 300 veterans. In fact, in 2020, 447 veterans were housed off of that registry, thus 447 left, and that number in 2021 was 433. So there is a population, senators, of veterans that are continuously, so to speak, on the list, but for the most part, that is not the case. Most veterans are entering, getting aligned with service, and transiting off the list. Interestingly enough, over that two-year period, we saw returning homeless veterans percent drop from 30 to 25%, which is very encouraging. And veterans who accessed housing through placement with a MACV service or service provider have less than a 10% return to homelessness rate. Now, some of that could very well be because of the pandemic, if you think about the moratorium and some of those things, but you know, this is our data today. We do continue to make progress. Just this past November, on Veterans Day, right before Veterans Day, the governor, along with Commissioners Herkey and Ho, announced that we reached our goal of functionally ending veteran homelessness in the 13 counties of central Minnesota continuum of care. Currently, 7 of our 10 continuums of care have functionally ended veteran homelessness in their communities. St. Louis County has submitted their documentation, so that's a matter of the time it takes to make it through the federal system to become the 8th to declare. With 8 of 10 continuums of care at functional zero, we and our partners can focus even more resources, and in our case, most of our resources, on Ramsey and Hennepin counties. That's what's remaining to make Minnesota the 4th state to declare functional zero to veteran homelessness. So what does 2022 hold? We'll continue to move veterans out of the emergency housing into hotels to longer-term and stable housing solutions. We'll expand our outreach, as we discussed, to shelters and unsheltered locations, expand our clinical services, forge new relationships with housing providers, and respond to the needs of Minnesota veterans at risk of eviction as we recover from the pandemic. We will continue to strategically expand into critical service areas for veterans who are unsheltered, living outside of the large population centers, or hesitant to engage with services because, unfortunately, they see themselves as different from the mainstream veteran population and not worthy, in need of, or otherwise eligible for help. We'll continue to adapt to the evolving needs of those that we serve. We are excited about the opportunity to engage in new program models to serve veterans with numerous barriers to housing stability. Receipt of contracts for MinVest and the SSVF Shallow Subsidy Program offers our providers additional tools to serve two different but emerging population subgroups of veterans struggling with housing instability. One, households who need ongoing financial assistance just to make the rent, but don't need the intensive case management. And two, individuals unable to qualify for any of the federal programs and some small version of the state programs for a variety of reasons, whatever reason, they're still homeless, but they still require services along the way. Speaking plainly, we'll continue our current mission alignment with the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. I think we're a better organization when our strategies and priorities are aligned, and we fully support the commissioner's efforts to build specific solutions for the chronic and long-term homeless population who will have to help address, who will have to help house if we're going to meet our objective. Simply put, we do need more supportive housing solutions for veterans, and we stand ready to support the state and their partners as we move forward in this area. Could not do this critical work without the support of our state partners, MNDVA, MHFA, DHS, and you. So thank you for your past support. Thank you for your consideration of future partnership with us in achieving our mission to end veteran homelessness in Minnesota.
Well, thank you, sir. Members, is there any questions? Mr. Loido. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you again, Mr. Loido. Question for you, I guess, and I might have missed it. I apologize if I did, but those numbers that you're providing that emergency hotel service to, what was the percentage that actually found the housing? You know, you said there's some of them just didn't fit for them, they left, but how many of the, and I don't remember the number, but what was the percentage found that?
Got my note here on which order I'm supposed to address everybody, so I'm sorry about that. My apologies, a little bit overzealous. It also says pause right here.
I'll accept that.
Chair Lang, Senator Howe, 65% reported positive outcomes. In there, we count about 7% who just exited the program. So 58% left the hotel program, Senator, into a longer-term housing solution. It might not be permanent yet because some of those transition into temporary housing to continue to work on, you know, addiction, mental illness, physical disability.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Loidolt, for being with us. Just wanted to know in those, you mentioned early on, 151 beds of transitional and permanent supportive housing. How safe and secure are those housing units for these homeless individuals? I mean, I sometimes think that where people live, their facilities aren't safe enough in and of themselves. I'm just wondering how secure you made them for these homeless vets.
Mr. Lloyd.
Chair Lang, Senator Anderson, just by way of background, Senator, those are 3 to 4 veterans in a single home. That's the highest density we have. I think we have one that's at 5 in Maplewood. So the first thing we do is we adjust who moves into which property based on what we know about their particular issues. We don't take people with violent pasts and put them with other veterans. We have some single places to put them. But we have also been able to improve over the past year, Senator. We have cameras. We have recorded video footage. We have a property manager, and we have, I mentioned that landlord engagement team. We have an individual whose responsibility is to go to those houses and check on what's happening. And it's unfortunate, but it's true, so I need to say it. We are sometimes in the business of evicting veterans from our own property, consistent with law and rule and regulation, but you can't allow somebody who has decided to go back on their whatever their substance of choice is to drag the other 3 or 4 veterans that they might be living with down, Senator.
Thank you. Follow-up question, Mr. Chair. On page 2, it says you your team leverages a variety of federal and philanthropic resources. Could you give a little bit broader what of those philanthropic resources are?
So, Chair Lang, Senator Anderson, we will this have raised this past year a little bit over $1.5 million, sort of on our own, if you will, Senator. That's from private individuals. That's from folks like you all here sending us $25 all the way up to $1 million donor or foundations like Target, Best Buy, et cetera. Most of that, not all, Senator, most of that money is considered general operating expenses, and so we can spend it as we choose. I don't spend it on administration. We're still running about 14% on administration, but what I can spend it on is the group of veterans who doesn't qualify for any of the other programs, and there are plenty, but it also allows us to do some innovative things, like occasionally we do fix a car. We have learned to buy a dangerous pet rider, so a veteran who will not go into shelter without giving up, you know, if they have to give up their pet, will go into an apartment, but we've found a way to mitigate, you know, with our landlords that way. And so that's the philanthropic resources that I'm referring to. And for those of you who are happen to watch WCCO, you know, we participated in the WCCO Home for the Holidays campaign this last December, and you know, we raised over $800,000 in that campaign that we used to address the gaps, seams in the programs that already exist.
Follow up, please. Mr. Chair, thank you. Another question on it says here that in 2021, you provided financial assistance to 239 veterans. And then in the next paragraph, it says, and we placed 193 veterans into employment. I'm wondering, are those 193 a part of that 239, or is that outside the 239 that you gave financial assistance to?
Chair Lang, Senator Anderson, the majority of those are fit into both categories.
Okay.
Normally, the normal system is you arrive to us to try to get some assistance with your housing. We are not a big jobs program trainer here in the metro. You know, you have DEED and DOL and Catholic Charities and Easter Seals that run pretty extensive programs. Our jobs program, think of them more, if you will, Senator, like liaisons and advocates to work with all the other partners to help you get a job. So the traditional inflow is you come to us for rental assistance, and we realize you've got no other way. You're not connected to the VA. You're not. You don't have a disability. You don't have a retirement. You don't have a pension. You're going to have to work. That's the crew then that transfers over. Now that 193 is out of the 1,400 that I mentioned to you later in the remarks. The 236 is our veterans that we paid rent for, specifically with funds appropriated to us by you all through the Department of Veterans Affairs.
One last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned on one of your pages says Justice Involved Veteran Initiative. Can you give me a snippet of what that all entails?
So we began to look about 3 years ago, right at the front of the pandemic, so it got delayed a little bit. And what happens to that population that leaves incarceration? And the Department of Corrections' own statistics say it's over 25% of veterans leave incarceration into homelessness. We wanted to try to, Senator, to address that population if we could before you enter homelessness, because, you know, it's about 10 times as expensive to take somebody who is currently homeless and in crisis and try to get them back on track than it is to keep somebody from going homeless, even if they're leaving prison. And so we worked with the Department of Corrections appropriately through law, rule, and regulation to be able to be informed on who the veterans are that are leaving incarceration, and on any given month there are approximately 12 veterans whose names then that we have that are leaving incarceration. So at the 90-day mark, depending upon the warden, but it's pretty consistent, our team is allowed to start to work with those veterans to see if we can't help them, the ones that need housing, can't help them line up stable housing so that they don't leave incarceration into homelessness. And we've been able to sort of surpass the barrier. There was a period of time where veterans would have to leave incarceration, Senator, and then spend a couple of nights in the shelter so that they could qualify for some other program. It really didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me that we would do it that way, and so we don't have to do that now. A number of those veterans leave incarceration right into one of the other programs, the properties that I mentioned to you before, and well, we help them. I will say this, you know, we're only at 17 right now as we've been running this program. They're pretty good tenants, quite frankly, Senator. They don't spend very long in our transitional housing. They've been incarcerated for so long. They're there long enough to try to figure out if and where they're going to work and how they're going to sustain their rents, and then they want to be moving on. You know, it's a group that's been living with, you know, people for a number of years.
Thank you.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's odd to call you Mr. Lloyd because of our past experiences together, but, you know, and I just kind of want to make a point that how important these type of services are, because back in, and I can't remember, I think it was 2007, I just happened to overhear a phone conversation of one of my soldiers, and did not realize that the soldier was homeless. She was living out of her car. She, her car broke down. And the phone conversation was on regarding a rental storage unit that she was begging them not to get rid of her stuff and sell her stuff because she just had just found a job and was going to be able to make things right. So lo and behold, the way she found the job is her car broke down, which is her only, was where she was living, and she happened to break down across the street from a garage, a service station, and she walked over there to borrow a tool because she didn't have that tool, and the person said, and the mechanic says, well, how do you know about that? Because not very many people know how to use that. She goes, well, I'm a mechanic. And the guy says, you want a job? And that was back in a tough period of employment time that is, you just couldn't find jobs back then. So it was kind of a godsend that she got that job. But we worked with Minnesota Military Family Foundation to get that storage unit paid, to give her rent done, and I assume that you work with them, but you don't know who sitting right next to you may be struggling with those problems. So it's we got to keep our eyes open. We got to help these folks because, to no fault of their own, they become unemployed and can't make those ends meet. So, just a good news story, but it almost had tragic endings on that piece. So, good work.
Thank you, Senator Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation, Mr. Lodo, and for the work that MACV does. It's really important. I have a couple of questions. One has to deal with when we talk about veterans. Are we talking about veterans that have only good papers, have been out of discharge, or are we talking about others who have been discharged for less than honorable conditions?
Ms. Lloyd?
Chair Lang, Senator Newton, we talk about all veterans. And I won't say that to be coy. I will explain what I mean by that. I think it's incumbent upon my finance team and the people that work for me to figure out how I can help you. After I understand that you honorably retired after 23 years, that puts you in one category. Senator Howell's veteran, actually, she wasn't a veteran likely at that time. She was serving. She was serving. She had. Okay, I'm sorry. But there's a group that doesn't have veteran status yet. And in fact, you know, by some arguments, you can have deployed, and if you're still in the National Guard, you're a currently serving member, you're not a veteran. So we are helping across the spectrum. We do follow the VA's rule, if you will, guidance, how about that, Senator, relative to, as you mentioned, bad paper. And then it depends on what it's for. But right now, if you're going to still be homeless at the end of the day, I'll try to find some fund, one of those philanthropic funds that we mentioned, to try to help somebody because they are still going to be homeless at the end of the day. Now, you may have been discharged for a thing that puts you in a category that I can't help you with right now, and we try to be straightforward with those veterans, Senator, but the days of us, of MACV, when we only had a federal program, turning away over half of the people that came to us because they couldn't explain a reason why we should help them when they were still going to be homeless. So that's the other thing that we do with the $1.5 million is we're paying to help people out of homelessness that don't qualify for anything else. Senator.
Good. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, if I can continue. Does MACV work with the veterans courts in making sure that we coordinate between the court and the veteran that appears before the court and your organization, sort of as a preventive measure to make sure that they don't, they're not sort of released from the court and left hanging out there.
Chair Lang, Senator Newton, I wish I could report to you that that happens all the time and in all cases. Unfortunately, it doesn't, and it's probably like veteran court overall from what I've read, which is there are places where we have all these really good players and actors and everybody cares, and the veterans court's a huge success, and we're part of those. And then there are other areas where veterans court just can't seem to get any traction. So I can suggest to you that in Duluth and in the northern region, because of a personality there that we have and a retired service member who's involved in the court system, and certainly in Mankato and in the southwest, we have a great presence there too, because it's a smaller population, I think, of veterans, Senator, than when we're here in the metro area and there's any number of folks going to veterans court. But where we are case managing a veteran who's involved in veteran court, the court usually makes a point of making sure that our representative participates in the discussions and the conversations and the follow-up on how things are supposed to happen.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Loyal, for the many positive things you're doing. I looked at your website, too, a lot of great reviews from persons that have received services. The report that you gave, I think, said 61% have a documented disability. And one thing, too, almost 40% have children. Can you amplify more as to what you're doing with the family of that vet? Because clearly the path to recovery and hope is going to involve that family. So could you comment further about the whole package in terms of services that might be available as you attack the goal of homelessness, but also in working with that family?
Ms. Lloyd.
Chair Lang, Senator Wieger, that's the total number, that the percentage is of veterans who say they have children. Mm-hmm. They could have adult children. They could have children that they're estranged from or that are no longer dealing with them. The number of families that we help, so that has to be a veteran, and so that's usually dependent children if it fits into the family categories, this past year was 21%. So that 21%, we help in a number of ways. The primary one being is the properties that I mentioned to you. We have two of those that are currently reserved, but we can flex as we need to, specifically for families. Secondly, we have a liaison who works primarily when it comes to families with the VA relative to the type of voucher you might be able to receive, because you can imagine it's much more difficult for us to help somebody find an apartment that has enough capacity for three kids, for instance, than a place that we're just looking for a single. In terms of programming for youth, we make referrals for that. I do not have a program that helps the youngsters of veterans other than, you know, us trying to help the veterans as best we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up. Obviously, resources are needed to help further accomplish the mission for housing, but then getting at mental health services, you know, the whole issue of opioids and chemical dependency and, you know, resources, I believe, additionally, are needed. If you could comment on, you know, is there greater efficiency in the bureaucracy that could be achieved? You mentioned there are so many different providers, but is there greater efficiency? And then also the final question, is there, outside of the financial, is there a policy or maybe two that if you were here and you could change the law up on policy, what would that policy be? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Loyal, that was a big one.
Chair Lang, Senator Wieger, if I could work in reverse order, if that'd be all right, and, you know, maybe take a little demur on the policy question, Senator. I just to simply say I didn't prepare much for being asked about a policy question, but we are challenged all the time by this definition of a veteran that Senator Newton asked about. Now, I don't know what the policy change would be because there are a lot of reasons for the definition, and when the taxpayer gets to vote in which veterans we help and how we help them and what their qualifications are. But the more that we have to parse, just we now, I'm only speaking about MACV, the more we have to parse veterans into certain little categories before we can figure out how to help them, then that relates to your first question. We would be more efficient if all I needed to do was just confirm some status of you as a veteran and then set out to figure out how to help you with your rent or your mental health or your mental illness. In some respects, relative to the government efficiency aspect, if you will, it's the very basic nature of why nonprofits exist, is because in cases governments have decided they're not going to be able to do it on their own, and they would be better served investing in someone else. So, you know, 60% of our funding is appropriated funding, and over $3 million on an annual basis and almost $6 million during the pandemic comes directly from the VA. Now, the VA wouldn't have to give me that money. It's not like when you appropriate money to me through the DVA. This is just money that the federal government gives to the VA. The VA could build its own homeless program, I suppose, but for some reason throughout the country, not just here in Minnesota, they've decided that this is a better place. And I believe some of that might be related to the bureaucracy, some of it might be related to efficiency and the fact that we're, you know, much closer to the ground, perhaps, than they are. But we are always working relative to that. And we were very fortunate, Senator Wieger, so I appreciate that part of the question. During the pandemic, the rules people gave us some grace. And allowed us, not just us, but across the spectrum, to do things that we didn't normally, weren't able to do. And we are fighting and clawing to keep those rules in place. I'll just give you, for instance, before the pandemic, both the state and the feds required a wet signature, the actual signature, the piece of paper that had the actual signature. Now, you can transfer money, you know, maybe Senator Howe can transfer money to his Swiss bank account on his phone. He can't. He doesn't. But you need to have an actual signature in order to get a copy of a Veterans 214. So those are the things that we sort of used the pandemic. We kind of clawed those back. We cut forms in half. But I think we will see some of those creep back in. And here, in the veteran space, how about that? Not to aim this at anybody, we are notoriously bad for still needing paper. We need paper. What's the? This paper is no better than a picture of this paper, and it prints the same way, and it's much more effective because we all have. Look, I got two computers over there and 25 sheets of paper here to be prepared, so we don't think anything of it. But most of the people we help don't have access to any automation, and so you think, well, how hard can it be to get those four forms? Well, if you've been living in a shelter, if you had, as Senator Howe mentioned, if you had somebody take your storage shed when you were gone on military duty, maybe even, or when you were homeless and you lost everything there, it's pretty damn difficult sometimes. And then be a female soldier and have a name change. Well, you know, you're running uphill the whole time, and so is our person that's trying to help you. So I wish I had a very specific answer for you, the name of a thing that could change, but I think if you're inclined to, whatever we can do to streamline the rules relative to appropriate use of the resources, it should still be appropriate use, but there are plenty of rules that probably don't still need to be in place, considering the current era that we're in.
Thank you, sir. I think, as always, the military committee has taken all the questions I wrote down during your testimony and asked them before they get to me. So they do a great job of that every week. So actually, all I wanted to say is a big thank you for the work you've done. Thank you for spending a little time with us on a Thursday morning. I appreciate it. And if there are some concerns, please reach out to myself or the committee, and we can go from there. And I truly appreciate the time.
Thank you, Chair Lang. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and thank you for all your past support as well.
Thanks. Next on the agenda, we have Veterans Day on the Hill presentation. Mr. Trent Dilks, another name that is known to the committee. Good morning. If you could identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Trent Dilks, Legislative Director for the Disabled American Veterans Department of Minnesota. and here to talk to you real briefly about the Veterans Day on the Hill event. I think everybody on the committee's kind of familiar with it. We've held it annually, except for the last 2 years here. We did a virtual event, which went okay, but excited to be back in person. And so we will be back in person this year for an event. It'll look similar as we can possibly make it to the previous events. Real quick, who the Veterans Day on the Hill, the participants. You've got the Disabled American Veterans, American Legion, VFW, Military Order of the Purple Heart, AMVETS, United Veterans Legislative Council, Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers, all the other acronym groups that have veterans involved are invited to participate and hold this rally. We're going to have it this year on April 20th. April 20th, we're going to have Veterans Day on the Hill, so a little bit later on in session. It's really a rally to highlight the veteran community's priorities, those that have been taking place, especially this late in the session, throughout the entire time, and really make sure that we amplify those. I think by April 20th, all the work will be done, so we'll probably just be here to celebrate all the bills that have been passed and signed, but on the outside chance there's some work left to be done, we'll be here to highlight those at the end of the session. So either way, but we'll have a rally. Let's see. So each year, the DAV partners with local communities. It doesn't have to be an organization. It can be a veteran in one of your communities that wants to bring in participants, and we pay half the cost of buses. We see much higher participation from greater Minnesota than we do actually. We have a hard time getting the metro veterans to drive or commute the short distance, but we get hundreds of veterans from all over greater Minnesota. We get those from the Iron Range leaving at 3 o'clock in the morning to get down here. It's really an impressive thing to see and to have an opportunity. We are looking at holding a lunch. Again, the DAV will provide a barbecue lunch. All the lawmakers are invited to stop over for that. Go through a timeline real quick of the day. Every year I try to set a time. So I've been doing Veterans Day on the Hill for 7 years. I think I've been kind of taking over on planning this. And every year we try to set a time. And if you know veterans, if you set a time, they're going to show up way before it. So we're just going to try to roll with that. Anywhere between 8 and 11, veterans are going to show up. They're going to be encouraged to come meet with you. So we're going to try to facilitate them setting up meetings with you, with their representatives, to come chat so you can let them know all of the work that's already been done and what needs to be done here at the end of the session. So I'm going to encourage them to meet with you. And then at 11 o'clock, we're going to start a lunch, kind of a pre-rally barbecue. Hopefully in the armory. We're working on locking that in, so that's not finalized, but we are working with the armory. So if you've stopped over there before, we kind of set it up by regions. So if you're looking for where your constituents might be, there'll be signs there that'll say, okay, these are from, you know, this area, that area. That way you can generally wander over to where your constituents are having barbecue if you want to chat with them. Going to have some remarks, community members come in, just kind of an informal in and out lunch there. Then at 12:30, they'll meet up at the Veteran Services Building. And I don't know why, but I really like bagpipes. So we'll get a bagpiper. And if you've seen it, the veterans march over, walk over from the Veteran Services Building up to the front of the Capitol. This year, we're 1 o'clock. We have the front steps of the Capitol reserved. I have put in my request for 68 and mostly sunny, but if that doesn't happen, we've also reserved the rotunda. So we'll either way, we should be all right. Invitations will be going out to all the lawmakers to Chair Lang to provide remarks if you'd like. Then we'll have a little rally there, hopefully on the front steps, but if not in the rotunda. Highlight again the needs and the things we're working on for veterans and wrap it up. So it's usually a great event. Pre-COVID, we were coming up over 1,000 veterans showing up. We can't predict, you know, who's going to show up, who's not going to show up. But we have seen some numbers, especially in the meetings that I've gone to around the state as we're highlighting the session, actually higher than expected. I think there's a lot of people who are a little stir crazy out there. So we're hopeful to have a decent turnout and get the veterans here and highlight the work that's been done. So, Mr. Chair, that's an overview. I will send out, as soon as this is all confirmed, I'll send out all of this in a flyer and an agenda. You can share it out, I hope, with the veterans in your community, and then you'll have the written down timeline. So I just got this at 6 o'clock this morning that we're starting to lock it in. So,
boy, Mr. Dilks, I appreciate the presentation and the idea. You know, this is an event that I look forward to every year. I don't think I've had a chance as a chair to address a group of vets that big, so they're often my most skeptical critics. So, and they know exactly what we're working on in here. So it's a very engaged group of individuals that I appreciate their input. So I don't know, members, any comments, questions for Mr. Dilks? Otherwise, I truly appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Dilks, I look forward to probably meeting you at the Pearl Lake Lodge for a bologna night or something like that, because we live so close together. So thanks for coming down.
Senator Weir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, we certainly look forward to the event. And maybe just for the record, would you like to reiterate the top three priorities for the session?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity. The top priority, especially coming from the DAV, we've actually already had our hearing with the Chair, Senator Lang, authored the bill for us here in the Senate, and that is a change to the property. Okay. First of all, Senator, I'd like to apologize. I'm here to talk a little bit about property tax value exclusion again. I became the property tax guy for 9 years. I thought I was done for the last two, but we have found a problem. With the addition of the Blue Water Navy veterans and finally recognizing their right to benefits and the devastating effects of Agent Orange on them, this just came into effect. We found that in the current statute, it says within 2 years of the death of the veteran. And we need to get that changed to 2 years of the award of benefits. Because you have veterans who died a decade ago who were denied benefits while they were alive. Their widows were denied benefits for another decade. And now when they go to get the property tax relief, they're denied because it says death and not when the benefits are awarded. The other group that's impacting is, I just got an email last week, widow of a veteran. She applied for her survivor's benefits. Her spouse died as a result of his service-connected injuries. The VA denied it wrongfully. Through no fault of her own, she was denied for 4 years. She just won her case against the VA, got the benefits that her husband and she had earned as his spouse, but the Minnesota statute reads 2 years of the death. So when she went to her county to get property tax relief, because when she finally gets the benefits, it's a 66% reduction in what the veteran themselves were getting. And then when she went to get this property tax relief, she was denied because, again, the wrong words in the statute. So it's not a major change, but this is a significantly impacted group we want to take care of. We'd like to take a look at the, at least starting the discussion. In Minnesota, the state constitution references a bonus to Minnesota's veterans of wars, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Gulf War, all of the wars except for Iraq and Afghanistan have been paid that bonus by the state of Minnesota. So if there's a surplus and we have to look at what to do with it, it might be time to look at our post 9/11, 21 years later. I don't think it was really an oversight as far as this one goes. It was just, when did the wars end? You know, when do you pay this bonus? Traditionally, it has been after, and these wars went on for two decades. So now with the withdrawal from Afghanistan complete and those things, we think it's time to take a look at kind of fulfilling our obligation here to our post 9/11 veterans and taking care of them like we have every other generation. And then the third one, it's really just more of a general support as we look at if there's going to be supplemental budget items and things like that. There's additional things to do for homeless veterans in the state, suicide prevention initiatives. And so it's more of a general monitoring and support of those. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about those. Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Dilks. I appreciate the presentation. I, again, appreciate the commitment to that. Both the Veterans Day on the Hill and the other initiatives that you were talking about, and I think we're all kind of on the same page with those items.
Thank you,
Mr. At least I won't speak for the other senators. But.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate the chance to be back here and in front of everybody. And
absolutely.
If we could just move the camera back a little bit, I think we'd all be a little better off, but that's all right. Thank you.
If you're complaining about the closeness and how big our heads look on camera, yeah.
I've been told I look better at a wider angle.
So. thank you. Next, we do have a couple of bills up that we should probably take a peek at. Senate file 2925, Senator Anderson. I'll give you a second to walk over to the table and Senator Anderson, to your bill.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, members, for the opportunity to present Senate file number 2925. It comes to the committee this morning. Actually, it came from the local government where it was passed out unanimously last week, but it's in regards to the county veteran service officers requesting that all military veterans be considered, especially as they get discharged from the service, that their fees that are charged by the county auditor be dismissed. And as a present, it's only been for three branches of the service. And I have a testifier, Mr. Greg Peterson, with me today to testify on behalf of that. He would like, along with his other county veteran service officers throughout the state, that all branches of the service be considered that the fee be displaced. So, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity and let you.
Oh, thank you, Senator Anderson. I do believe I've seen Mr. Peterson on there. There he is. And if you could just identify yourself for the record and continue the testimony.
Sure. Thank you very much, Senator Lang. My name is Greg Peterson. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers, and I'm also working in conjunction with the Commander's Task Force. We come with this as one voice. Senator Anderson had said, there was the language was written in 1919. It gave Army, Navy, and Marine Corps veterans the opportunity to record their military discharges, their DD-214s, just like Mr. Lloydout was speaking about how hard it is to get those sometimes. They should all be recorded in county courthouses. The same thing. We record death certificates, we record the birth certificates, marriage certificates, land changes, documents, things like that. All those things have a recording fee. A discharge would incur about a $40 recording fee. There is no indication that any county recorder has charged a fee for the Air Force or the Coast Guard, who were not branches of the service in 1919. I think maybe with now the establishment of the Space Force, looking at different statutes. There's some other ones that reference Army, Navy, and Marines. And this is just simply a cleanup of the statute. Armed Forces of the United States, we think, would encompass all branches right now and any in the future.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson.
You're welcome.
Members, any questions for either testifier or Senator Anderson? Senator Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, Senator Anderson, on the certificate of discharge. Why don't we say DD Form 214?
Senator Anderson?
Because I unless the county officials are familiar with a certificate of discharge or a DD Form 214, they're liable to have just a certificate, a general certificate that you get when you leave the service. And it's really the 214 that we're looking for, isn't it? I mean, I think that's what the county veteran service officers want.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newton, I would ask county veteran service officers to look at that question and give a response. It basically, they're the ones that are looking at all the different individuals who come out of the service and find out what they're looking for as far as paperwork, and then submitting it to the county auditor. And there's been a fee, but it hasn't been charged. So I guess I would defer to Mr. Peterson.
And Mr. Peterson, I don't know if you have an answer to that.
Senator Lang, Senator Majerus. They weren't always called the DD-214. So your World War II discharges were not DD-214s. Presumably, there's no one that needs to record a military discharge from World War II. But yeah, they're called DD-214s now. Will that change in the future? It could be. I think this is encompassing enough. You know, there's no county recorder who doesn't know what a military discharge is. They have told us, I've spoken to their former president of their association, that this statute is touched on in their training. It could come down sometime to somebody that wants to follow the exact letter of the law, much like the assessors are doing with the property tax and the widows. They're following the letter of the law and denying people. So we feel, the CBSOs feel, that discharge certificates is a broad enough term to identify the military discharge, the DD-214, than it is now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Members, any additional questions? Well, Senator Anderson, this looks like, if you would like to make the movement that Senator Anderson, that 2925 be recommended to pass, and this one will be sent to general orders.
Mr. Chair, I would so move that motion that you just made as a statement, so I appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Member, Senator Anderson moves that Senate file 2925 be recommended to pass and sent to general orders. All in favor say aye and raise your hand.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, raise your hand and say nay. The bill does pass.
Aye. Thank you, members. Appreciate the opportunity.
Perfect. Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Good luck. Yeah, I hope it goes as smooth.
The next bill on the agenda today, Senate File 1003, authored by Senator Howe. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill would establish a license plate, a special plate, for air medal recipients.
Senator Howe, I believe we do have an amendment.
I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair. It's the A1 amendment. It's a technical amendment, basically just changes the date from 2022 to 2023. So I'd like to move that amendment, the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Senator Howe moves that the A1 author's amendment be voted on and recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye and raising your hand.
Aye.
All opposed, raise your hand and say aye. The amendment is adopted. There we go. Senator Howe, the bill is drafted in a way that I think you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, the air medal, from my understanding, and I'm not an aviator, so I don't have one of these. But from my understanding, it's on the same level as a Bronze Star. I do have one of those, and I do have those plates. So I would think that if we're going to recognize those folks that have a Bronze Star, and if there's another equivalent medal, they should have that opportunity to display that that award on their license plate also. Mr. Chair, I'd like to go to our testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Howe. And on the list of testifiers, we have Mr. Jim O'Neill. Mr. O'Neill, are you present? There he is. Good morning. And if you could identify yourself and proceed.
My name is James O'Neill, Chair Lang and members. I am an Air Force veteran. I received a commission through Air Force ROTC at the University of St. Thomas, and I went on active duty for 4 years from March 17th, 67 through March 17th, 71. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I served in Southeast Asia from September 30th, 69 to October 1st, 1970. I was first stationed in Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City now, I guess so. And I was on the Air Force battle staff. Our job was to coordinate and run the air war over North Vietnam with the Army, Navy, and the Air Force efforts. In February of 1970, I was transferred to the Airborne Battle Staff, which flew out of Udorn, Thailand. Our job was to fly 12-hour missions and direct the air war from areas either in South Vietnam or over North Vietnam. I flew 57 combat missions. Our missions were about 12 to 13 hours apiece, so I had over 700 plus combat hours. And during this time, I was awarded two air medals. In 1971, after I left the service and returned to civilian life, I went to work for corporate America. We didn't discuss much of our military service or our time in Vietnam during that time because the country was divided pretty much, and it wasn't very comfortable to talk about. While I was working in civilian life, I did use the VA benefit to go back to graduate school, and I was going to Mankato State, the extended campus up in the Twin Cities, and courses were taking place on the Air Force Base, Reserve Base, and at that time, I met the commander of the 934th Tactical Airlift Group, and I joined the reserves. And we had a number of people that were also veterans in my outfit, but pretty much we kept to ourselves. After 9/11, for some reason, I decided to buy Vietnam vet plates just to kind of show my support of what was going on at that time. And it was 6 or 7 months after I put the plates on the car that I was out to lunch with some of my fellow workers. And when I returned to my car, there was a note on the window from a mother and her young children thanking me for my service. And mainly the only reason it was there because of the license plate. And that was the first time in 30 years that anybody ever thanked me, a Vietnam veteran, for my service. And it was kind of an emotional thing. Since then, I've gotten lots of conversations and comments and thank for my service, which I think was a result of the country coming together after 9/11. But I think the thing that I most appreciated, it was a way for me to reconnect with other veterans that were in the same situation that I was, that, returned to civilian life and now had an opportunity to know who their cohorts were that had served, and they could exchange some of their feelings and experiences. And I think it helps veterans when they're able to talk to each other to cope with returning to civilian life if they've had any problems. As I renewed my license plate, I did notice that there were plates for people that had bronze stars, silver stars, and other awards. And so I reached out to my House of Rep, and this was in 2018, to Lori Pryor, and asked her, because of what the DOT told me, or DMV, I guess, that it had to go through the House and then the Senate. And at that time, she got involved with me and put forth an effort. I think it was House File 4429. And since then, her and my senator have been trying to get this bill passed. The Air Medal is not just it's for aviators, and it is kind of the equivalent to the Bronze Star. We've had a large number of, we've got the Air National Guard, we've got the Air Force Reserve, both in Minneapolis and up in Duluth. The Navy had a big presence when I was in college out at the airport. And actually they were in charge of the base for a while until the Air Force took it over. And the Army and the Army National Guard has a big aviation presence here in Minnesota over at Holman Field. So there are a number of people in this state, I'm sure, that have received the Air Medal either on active duty or now in, seems that the reserves are activated way more than they used to be when I was in the reserve. I also joined a Facebook group called the Air Medal Society, and noticed there that there were a number of states that had Air Medal license plates. And when I first testified before the House and the Senate in 2020, I put together a package of the different states that offered the Air Medal and what their plates looked like. Because it's remote now, I haven't done that to send it to the committee. But Texas, Virginia, West Virginia, Georgia, Mississippi, over half the states in the United States do offer that. So I think my request, as I've gone through this the last 4 years, is almost more not for personal recognition, but just to reconnect and to enable veterans to be able to discuss with each other. You know, it's not just the Vietnam vets or the Iraqi vets or the Afghanistan vets or the World War II vets in particular, but it just crosses all generations and helps, I think, people to reconnect with civilian life. So, I don't know, that's about all I have to offer. I've lived here in the state of Minnesota since 1961, moved up here after I graduated from high school and started college, have been here for the exception of the 4 years I were serving in the country as in the Air Force. And I had a 4-year stint over in Wisconsin for my civilian corporation, and then I moved back here. I love Minnesota, don't wanna leave here, but it's the only thing I've asked the state to do for me is to create this this plate, and I hope it gets through before you guys decide to have a age limit on when I can drive my truck around town. So I don't know if there's any questions, but I appreciate you listening to me ramble here. So thank you.
Members, do you have any questions for either the testifier or Senator Howe? Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. O'Neill, for your service, your testimony. Absolutely support it, and let's hope it's you'll have that license. During your testimony, I thought of Joe O'Neill, and I don't know if you are his brother, but you know he's a former state senator who left us last month, and he looks a lot like you, and he was in the Air Force, like I said, in the reserve. He did legal counsel for the Air Force, and he was such a highly respected member of the state Senate. So I thought of Joe as you were talking. Are you related to Joe?
No, oh, excuse me. Chair Lang and Senator Wieger. No, not directly related to him. I moved up here from southern Wisconsin, Chicago area, but I have been told I look like a lot of the other O'Neills. I don't know, I guess maybe because we all come from a small island. But if that helps get this license plate passed, yeah, somewhere along.
It certainly does help, Mr. Chair, and he was survived by a brother, Jim, so I'll figure that out. I did read the obituary.
Thanks, Senator Wieger. And Mr. Peterson, I inadvertently skipped over you, so I don't know if you would like to testify.
Well, that's okay. If there's time, I'd still like to testify.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, Greg Peterson, again, with the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers and the Minnesota Commanding Task Force. I am a retired Air Force loadmaster. I have 6,500 flight hours in the C-141 and the C-17 jet transports. As was stated, the Air Medal is a military decoration created in 1942 and is awarded for single acts of heroism or meritorious achievement while participating in aerial flight. I received my Air Medal in 1996 for supporting NATO's intervention in Bosnia and Herzegovina. I'm sure that all of us here in the room have traveled at some point in our lives by air. You know, that's where you experience the exhilaration. So the raw power of rolling down the runway for takeoff. I know, Senator Lang, your aerial space vehicle doesn't necessarily roll down the runway, but you still use a lot of power to get her into the air. There's experiences of all air travelers. I won't go into them. But military aviators have those same experiences on a daily basis, except they're flying into hostile and foreign airfields, generally at night and in poor weather conditions, and receiving hostile ground fire sometimes. And when our aviators have a successful mission, that means we're carrying on the mission in the United States. About 3 weeks ago, United States Special Forces did a hit deep into Syria, I think it was. Several Black Hawk helicopters flew in there. No one was injured. Everybody came home safely. Those pilots and air crewmen will certainly receive the Air Medal for their actions. Those men that charged into that compound carrying their weapons most certainly will receive the Bronze Star for their heroic actions. As Mr. O'Neill said, his Vietnam plates allowed him to connect with veterans. Yesterday, I was at a Beyond the Yellow Ribbon ESGR signing up in Little Canada, and there was a military man there in uniform, and he had wings on, as I have on my lapel here. So I immediately made the connection with him as an aviator. Turns out it was Major General Mankey, the adjutant general. And so when I saw his wings and we talked a little bit, I said, hey, you have an Air Medal? I sure do. Well, good, because I'm going to mention your name tomorrow in some testimony. In previous, some House testimony, the question always comes up, well, how many? How many Air Medal recipients are out there? And that's a tough one to figure out. We've, with Mr. O'Neill's help, we've done some questioning on our Facebook post there. But we just can't pin it down. I would say I think there are a lot. I know of one individual in Albert Lee that has over 20 Air Medals, but that's just one person who was a door gunner in Vietnam. I think of our greatest concern, Mr. O'Neill and myself, is there are both a House and a Senate file that will remove the authority from special plates from the legislature. Might be a good thing, so you don't have to sit through these hearings on all these special plates, and hand it over to the Department of Public Safety. But we're almost certain we're never going to get an Air Medal license plate if it goes off to another department who just doesn't understand or may not be able to take the testimony of those that are so passionate for this. So I'm advocating, as the legislative director from Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers, and certainly 87 counties and hundreds of thousands of veterans that we represent there, and then the eight organizations within the Commander's Task Force. You know, we're coming in with a pretty big ask here. Are a lot of veterans behind it? So we're representing all of them. That's about all I have to say about the Air Medal. Well, I actually have a, you know, each medal has a precedence when it's when you're wearing them on your uniform. I have medals that have greater precedence than the Air Medal. But the Air Medal is my favorite one because it is for aviators who have done heroic actions, meritorious service to the country. That's all I've got for you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Peterson, for your service and for your diligence in serving our country. I thank you for your ongoing service to our veterans throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
You're welcome, sir. And I guess I have one thing in hindsight. Senate file 3299 is the one to remove special plates from legislative authority and move it to Department of Public Safety. Sorry I had to blurt that in there, but Thank you, Senator Lang. Senator Anderson.
Senator Herr with a question.
Yes. thank you, Commander Peterson, for that information. I'll keep an eye on that so we don't support it, because we do still want to have to, actually, you know, we still want to have the honor of, you know, approve, you know, things that recognize veterans. And I think the veterans will be very honored to have that privilege as well, to come and testify, and, you know, we get approval from legislation. And I really appreciate, you know, your service as well as the service of Mr. Jim O'Neill, who has been so, put his life on the line to protect, you know, American freedom and protect people like me back in the days during the Vietnam War, and built allies. And so, you know, recognition is priceless. You know, they do say money bring happiness, but sometimes not all money that bring happiness. But recognition like this, the Air Medal, will bring honor, dignity, you know. And I for one, understand that very, very well, because I have been fighting for recognition of the Special Guerrilla Unit. So this is just one little piece that we can honor those who put their life in the line, honor the warrior code. And so, you know, I just want to say you have my support, and thank you for coming to testify.
Thank you, Senator Herr. Senator Howe, I believe, you know, as we go forward with this, being a recipient of it myself, and you knew that, I don't know, there's talks about heroism and meritorious gallantry service of any kinds, and I think you should probably add, you know, stupidness and possibly high-risk scenarios that probably shouldn't have been done at the time in my case, but... with the Senate File 1003, if you would like to make the motion that it be recommended to pass and be referred to Transportation and Finance Policy Committee.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Members, Senator Howe moves that Senate File 1003 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, raise your hand and say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, raise your hand and say nay. The bill does pass and is re-referred to the Transportation and Finance Committee. So members, next week, we do have an MDVA presentation that'll be coming. There is some supplemental budget requests as we go forward from the department. And there's probably, depending on what Dave and I can cook up for next week or what we decide to hear, some other bills that'll be coming in front of you as well. So. We're going to try and get those posted Monday afternoon or Tuesday. So unless there's any questions or announcements. Perfect. With no further business, this committee stands adjourned. Thank you. Yeah.